welcome to The Signal. I'm Christina Pappas.
And I'm Ben Bogstie. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Stick with us for the next half hour, and we'll tell you what's going on in Halifax this week.
Today on the show, lobster season law enforcement.
We will put on camo gear and we'll hide away in the woods so we can watch what activity's taken on.
How Canada's biggest lobster fishery is handled.
In this production, transgender representation plays an important role.
I never thought that I would get to be part of the stories we told as my authentic self.
How this cast member is changing the face of local theater.
And later,
it certainly was very apparent to me that my gender really mattered a lot in how I experienced everyday city life.
All that and more on today's show. But first, Nova Scotia has the largest proportion of people living with disabilities in the country, 18% of the population. Many need special housing, but there are few appropriate options. In 2013, the province agreed to pay for 8 specialized care homes, serving about 30 people. So far, 2 have been constructed. 1,500 people are on a growing wait list. Andrea McGuire met 2 women hoping to reduce that number.
Jen Powley is quadriplegic and has progressive multiple sclerosis. She's also an author and an activist who needs a place to live with 24-hour care. Her voice is weak, so her friend Emma Cameron helps her speak.
So she said, "My name's Jen Powley, and I fight for what we deserve, we being people with disabilities."
Powley and Cameron lead the group No More Warehousing. They want the province to fund smaller co-housing units for people with severe physical disabilities instead of placing them in nursing homes with seniors. Ruth Strubank is the executive director of the Nova Scotia Association for Community Living. She says nursing homes can isolate people with disabilities from their communities.
For younger people, living in a nursing home is not an appropriate placement for them nor for the residents that are there.
In February, Powley and Eco Green Homes Limited proposed an apartment renovation to house her and 3 other people with disabilities, along with a care worker. Powley says it would cost the same as placing them in a nursing home. The developer expected to hear back from the province in 2 months. Now, it's been 9.
He's been really, really patient, but obviously he, at the end of the day, is a business person, and I think he's kind of at the end of his rope.
Community co-housing proposals like Powley's are the UN's recommended model. Diana Melanson supervises one in Red Deer, Alberta. Her agency has 43 group homes for people with disabilities. They even have vacancies.
They go and they shop at Sobeys and Walmart. They go out to eat, just like everybody else. And people in the community have embraced that. And in my opinion, it's been extremely successful.
Strubank would love to see the Nova Scotian government implement a similar model.
When communities really include and embrace and invite everyone, we all live better full lives.
Powley is gathering names on a petition she hopes to present to government. For The Signal, I'm Andrea McGuire.
Some people, like Powley, are trying to build new things in Halifax. Others are trying to keep some old buildings standing. The Heritage Advisory Committee has once again recommended council designate the Old Memorial Library site on Spring Garden Road as a heritage property. For the past 5 years, the former library has sat empty, unused, and full of asbestos. But as Alex Scultetti tells us, there's a big complication for any future use.
The Heritage Advisory Committee members agree the Old Memorial Library is an important part of Halifax's history. And as Aaron Murnahan, principal planner with the Regional Municipalities, explains, there's more than just the building to consider.
Probably the biggest, most significant historical piece about the property is the existence of thousands of burials from the time when the property was the site of the Poorhouse Cemetery from about 1760 up until 1870.
Halifax resident David Bentley submitted the application to have the old library added to the Heritage Registry. The decision now rests with council. It chose not to pass a similar recommendation in 2011. Councillor Sam Austin says things may have changed since then.
We know what's going on a little bit more with the building, that we're having a hard time finding a reuse for it. It's not a bad time to revisit.
Wei Mason is the councillor for downtown South Halifax. He's also in favour of adding the site to the registry.
I don't know what we're going to do with the library itself, but that site is very historically important, and I think it's really important that Grafton Park does not get developed.
Dalhousie University and the city are considering a joint proposal to add an architectural school and offices for planning staff to the old building. Archaeological assessments would have to happen before any digging, as cemeteries fall under provincial protections. For The Signal, I'm Alex Scoltetti.
This week marked the start of lobster season in Halifax. After a brief delay because of bad weather, the traps have finally been set along Nova Scotia's South Shore region. Leslie Tatum went to the docks to talk with the people who ensure the fishing season is safe and successful.
Lobster fishermen aren't the only ones hard at work at this time of the year. It's also the busiest season for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. This is the biggest lobster fishery in the country. The DFO staff works with conservation officers, the Coast Guard, and scientists to ensure a successful season. Kevin Crew is with the Coast Guard's search and rescue team. He says lobster crews face some big risks.
We have a large number of vessels heading out to drop lobster pots, which they have loaded onto their boats, which could very well have, there could be some overloading and stability issues with the vessels. So we're concerned for making sure that all these high-risk factors are looked after, and we mitigate that by having extra resources brought in hand.
The Coast Guard works to protect fishing crews. DFO conservation officers are busy protecting lobster stocks, trying to prevent overfishing. Bill Wolf is with the Liverpool Detachment. He says they do much more than just at-sea patrols.
We use all kinds of different tactics. We overtly do patrols on land with vehicles. We do foot patrols. We do a lot of dockside checks where we would drive out from wharf to wharf to check for compliance. We also do some covert operations where we will put on camo gear and we'll hide away in the woods so we can watch what activities taking on.
In the first days of the season, the preparations appear to have paid off, with no accidents or injuries reported. The fishery, which runs until May, is a huge employer and big business. It's worth almost $500 million. For The Signal, I'm Leslie Tatum.
Thanks, Leslie. And if you're thinking about lobster for Christmas, the prices are really high. $14.99 a pound at Clearwater Seafood.
Wow, that's expensive. Did you know I actually had lobster for Christmas a couple years ago?
Did you? That sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's nice to switch things up. Emergency planners in Halifax want people to be more prepared for climate-related disasters. They're holding educational pop-up events. Felicia Chandler popped by one in Dartmouth and has the story.
Jane Young volunteers with Halifax's emergency management team. She helps people who have been affected by disasters such as flooding or fires.
I've been in an evacuation center where one lady was told she had 10 minutes to get out.
Young says preparation is vital. That's why emergency planners like Shiloh Gempton are holding a series of pop-up events to show people they can protect themselves and their loved ones from climate change hazards.
So this plan is both adaptation and mitigation, looking at climate hazards and how communities can adapt to these things. So that would include anything from drought, fire, sea level rise, invasive species, storm surges. It covers quite a variety of hazards. The mitigation side, we're also looking at targets to reduce emissions.
Satya Raman lives nearby this pop-up. She's concerned for vulnerable people that may be more affected by climate-related hazards.
I think we need to do this. This is a community that has a lot of people who have settled here fairly recently. English may not be their first language. There's a lot of seniors here. We have actually a very high percentage of low-income population. And so when these things happen, people don't have the ability to get supplies, they can run out. It introduces a lot of vulnerabilities.
Has more pop-up events planned to help people be ready for climate-related emergencies. And the goal is to have one in every neighborhood in HRM. For The Signal, I'm Felicia Chandler.
Neptune Theatre's latest musical is opening this weekend. Peter Pan is going to whisk audiences away to Never You Mind Land. But one cast member is bringing an important piece of representation to Neptune's stage. Chris Studley checked it out.
Give me that, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on, I'm a superstar.
Avery Jean Brennan is the first out transgender woman to take Neptune Theatre's main stage. She's playing Fudge, a trans feminine girl who came to what the production is calling Never You Mind Land to find herself.
I hope audiences get from seeing me on stage is sort of the idea that this doesn't have to be an anomaly, because I grew up as someone who never got to see this happen on stage and never thought it would happen because of that.
Brennan says there's high unemployment in the transgender community. She'd like to see that inclusion in other workplaces too.
It's the responsibility of any business owner to educate themselves on the needs of their employees and the needs of their patrons and everybody to really make sure that they're creating a space that isn't harmful.
And Neptune Theater is trying to do just that. Jeremy Webb is the artistic director. He wants to make sure his shows don't just represent white, middle-aged, privileged men like himself.
My belief is that theater in general should represent everyone. Everyone should be able to see themselves on stage. Everyone should feel safe coming into this building and welcomed in. And over the last couple of years, we've worked so hard on that.
Neptune's next season will see even more representation on stage. Webb says there will be even more from the queer community and more Indigenous artists and stories. For The Signal, I'm Chris Dudley.
Peter Pan will bring tons of pop songs and jokes to Neptune's Fountain Stage. It'll run from November 29th to January 5th of next year.
Still with the arts, Eye Level Gallery in Halifax is getting ready to celebrate a new space and a new beginning. It's been an important place for emerging arts for more than four decades, but urban growth made it hard to find affordable rentals. Sam Gillett reports.
Right now we are what's seen to be my office and also kind of a community gathering space.
Sally Wolchin-Rabb walks past tools and paint cans through the top floor of a house on Gottingen Street. It's about to be the new home of Eye Level, and renovations are almost done. Eye Level is a not-for-profit, artist-run center that promotes and develops artists. But the organization hasn't had a permanent home where they could host events since 2013.
So like every artist talk has to happen somewhere, and every board meeting has to happen in a different location. It does kind of it can cause you to lose touch with your community in that way.
In Halifax, a development boom and rising rent prices have proved challenging for many nonprofits like Eye Level. Eye Level had to abandon its last permanent location on Gottingen Street in 2013. Another community art space, the Khyber, also had to move. Adriana Afford runs Argyle Fine Art. She says physical spaces where people can see art and develop skills are vital to the community.
I think it's important to have as many community spaces as you can. I think we've lost a lot of that.
Sam Stein is an ASCAD student. He says that community art spaces fill a void that institutional galleries like the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia cannot.
Not that it's something unique to Eye Level, but just that we really need as many of those spaces as we can.
Work is almost done on the center. Now, it'll have affordable studio spaces for artists, as well as a bookstore for alternative publications. It's taken Eye Level a long time to find a new space, and they're glad to be back in part of Gottingen's redeveloping streetscape. For The Signal, I'm Sam Gillett.
Tonight, Eye Level is hosting a fundraiser. They'll be selling some very cool t-shirts designed by local artists.
So Ben, it's Black Friday. Any shopping for you today?
No, nothing for me today. The bank account's on life support, so just trying to make it to the holidays.
I might have to join you on that. Well, this is one of the biggest shopping days of the year, but some people are looking beyond that. Have a listen.
Black Friday and Cyber Monday come with a flurry of flash sales and big savings to mark the start of the holiday giving and spending season. But after the consumer frenzy comes Giving Tuesday, an international day to take time to think about giving back to communities. Margaret Murray is with the Canadian Mental Health Association, Halifax Dartmouth. The CMHA participates in Giving Tuesday. But Murray says it's about more than donations.
You know, we want people to be caring for one another. There are so many people who just really benefit from someone spending time with them. Giving Tuesday is all about giving. It doesn't just have to be to a particular organization. You can think about how you can give back, you know, in your own life. That's, I think, something that's very special about that day.
At the CMHA office on Gottingen, Roy Muse is helping out. He used the programs at the CMHA for support at one time. Now he's been a volunteer for over 20 years. He's felt the impact of spending time with people. He says it can change lives.
We were coming up Spring Garden Road. He had lived in Halifax at that time for 30 years, and it was the first time he had seen Spring Garden Road and the lights at night. And he was just amazed, and I'm like sitting there thinking, we just take so much stuff for granted.
The extra donations or awareness from Giving Tuesday are important for the social programs they offer.
Our social programs really support people who are experiencing, you know, social isolation and loneliness.
But Murray says giving can be anything from donations, time, spreading awareness through social media, or being kind to people. And Ben, all of the organizations participating in Giving Tuesday can be found at givingtuesday.ca. The CMHA is welcoming people to visit them at the community booth at Scotia Square on Tuesday over the noon hour. They'll also have mosaic art tiles for sale.
You're listening to The Signal, storytelling from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Ben Bogstie.
And I'm Christina Pappas, still to come on the show.
A boon to baseball.
And I have no doubt at some point there will be female athletes playing Major League Baseball.
Nova Scotia's response to the first full-time female MLB hitting coach.
One man finds the secret to scholarships is right in front of him.
It kind of just kicked me in the face. Wow, there's a solution that can be created using technology?
The future of funding is fast approaching.
Recording a regimen.
We're all showing up for the same reason. The reason is joy. The reason is to express ourselves through music.
Last year, a Dartmouth man wrote a song every week. Now he's looking to make an album out of that project. If you've ever gone to a Mooseheads game in Halifax, you'll know that arena was built for men.
That's right. The lineups for the women's bathroom are crazy. There aren't enough stalls.
Well, Leslie Kern is a professor and author who thinks a lot about that kind of thing. Specifically, how cities are largely designed by men, for men. Her new book is a study of that. It's called Feminist City, a Field Guide. She's on tour across the country this week. She'll be in Halifax this Sunday. We reached Kern by phone in Vancouver. Hi, welcome to The Signal. How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for being with us today. So, Leslie, what made you want to write about the link between gender and city planning?
Well, in my day job at Mount Allison, I'm a professor of urban geography and also women's studies. So these things kind of naturally come together for me out of my interest, but also from my personal experience. I grew up in and around Toronto, lived there for many years before moving to the East Coast, and it certainly was very apparent to me that my gender really mattered a lot in how I experienced everyday city life.
What are some ways that cities prioritize the needs of men?
Well, if we look at public transit, for example, most transit systems were set up really to accommodate the male breadwinner commuting in from the suburbs for his, you know, 9-to-5 office job. And we find that women are much more poorly served by public transit. They tend to be juggling more responsibilities of both home, childcare, and paid work. And often their routes in and around the city are much more complex. They require more transfers. They have children with them. They're running errands. And the system, both physically in terms of its accessibility, is not great for trying to get a stroller or children or packages onto the subway. And the way that it's organized spatially also tends to make women's lives more inconvenient than those of the imagined typical male commuter.
So how much of an effect does this have on women?
Well, it has a variety of effects. So research has shown that women pay a so-called pink tax, for example, on a lot of products that are branded for women, but in the city as well. So women spend more typically on transportation costs than men do, in part because of these kinds of multiple trips that they take, but also safety issues. So women might not feel comfortable walking at certain times or using public transit, and thus will pay more for their cab or Uber ride, or perhaps even private transportation with their own car in order to avoid potential harassment or violence in public.
So what are some examples of what cities have done to better accommodate women?
So one example that gets talked about a lot is the city of Vienna. So they instituted what's called gender mainstreaming, which is where all of their urban policies like budgets, planning practices have to go through a gender lens, which means that they're looking to see, you know, if we build this here or run this bus route there, will it enhance gender equity or not? So some of the things that have been done there are creating kinds of urban spaces where there is sort of very close access to school, healthcare, paid employment, leisure space, all of those kinds of things that we all need to access on a very regular basis, but in some cases, they're far-flung. So that's one example of kind of how they try to really listen to women, say, what are your day-to-day experiences of the city, and how can we design things to just make that a little bit easier?
So what else can cities like Halifax do to address this?
Well, we definitely need to keep increasing the representation of women in city politics, in professions like urban planning and architecture, where they tend to remain very underrepresented. But anything I think that enhances, as I mentioned, affordability, particularly of housing, but also of transportation costs and food costs, is going to have an important impact on women's lives. And, you know, keeping safety issues at the front of mind as well. So women do express a lot of fear in urban public spaces, and making sure that cities are very aware of issues of lighting, of good, safe access to transit, of the kinds of urban public spaces that are not going to become fearful for women.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Those are great questions. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
If you'd like to hear more about Leslie Kern's work, you can check out her presentation, Feminist City, How to Build a More Just, Sustainable Halifax. That takes place this Sunday at 7 p.m. at Dalhousie University's Marion McCain Building on University Avenue.
This week, the New York Yankees hired the first female full-time hitting coach to work for a major league team. It's a move that's reverberating here in Halifax, where there are 1,200 coaches, but only about a sixth of them are women. Kate Woods has more.
And the wind blowing out. There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run.
Some say the hiring of Rachel Balkovic is a home run for women in the sport. Jen Donaldson has been coaching for 10 years for her daughter's teams.
Part of me said it's about time and like unsurprised, and the other part of me was just really surprised because I know what it's like as a woman coach in a male-dominated sport. So I was pretty impressed and proud.
Her 15-year-old daughter, Neela Anderson, is the only girl on a team that's mostly boys.
It sucks. A lot. There's just games where there's just teams that are gross and that boys just don't get it.
She hopes Balkovic's hiring will send those boys a signal. Mike Crawford is vice president of female baseball with Baseball Nova Scotia. He said he started coaching when his daughter started to play.
When I watched some of the attitudes that some of the traditional coaches had, it didn't strike it the right chord with me, so I decided if I wanted to do anything about it, I had to get involved.
Brandon Gannett is the executive director of Baseball Nova Scotia, which is offering free coaching classes for women.
I think our main goal is to increase opportunities for females to get into coaching, period.
The Yankees have made the pitch for women in the major leagues, and players like Neela Anderson hope that may pave the way for more females in Nova Scotia to play ball and coach. For The Signal, I'm Kate Woods.
Debt is a fact of life for many university students. Scholarships can help, but only if students can find them. The search can be time-consuming and frustrating. I met one local entrepreneur with a plan to change that. Brianna Kelly is a master's student at Dalhousie University studying social anthropology. She's applied for one scholarship, but hasn't had time to apply for others.
I was in the middle of finishing my undergrad, doing an honors, working jobs to pay for my school, so I do not have time to apply for other scholarships, when, especially when you're not guaranteed to actually get the money.
According to Statistics Canada, undergraduate students owe an average of $28,000 when they graduate. Scholarships are an alternative to loans, but money offered by businesses, charities, or other organizations can be hard to find and apply for. Much of it goes unclaimed each year. Charles Milton is a former Nova Scotia Community College student. He was eligible for 126 scholarships, but he couldn't apply to them all. That inspired him to develop a database that could potentially connect students with millions of dollars in scholarships.
Then when I realized how long it would actually take to apply to multiple scholarships, I realized if I wanted to apply to all 126 scholarships, which was $250,000 worth of money, with 5 to 7 hours per scholarship, I was looking at about 7.5 weeks worth of work. I thought it was really lengthy and that there had to be a better way to get it done.
Milton and his team are developing Bursity.ca. He says it will save students a lot of time.
It kind of just kicked me in the face. Wow, there's a solution that can be created using technology, and then automating the application process by being able to apply to multiple scholarships with a universal form.
After a year of research, Milton says Bursity.ca is now in the development phase. He hopes a full rollout will follow soon. Ben Bogsty, The Signal, Halifax.
Churches used to be a staple of every community. These days, they're under pressure. Churches are combining or even closing, and that's having a big effect on congregations and the clergy. Olivia Malley has more.
Jennifer Moore is a parish resource for family and youth services from Windsor to Weymouth, and she notices a smaller, aging congregation.
We do have a large number of that baby boomer generation in some of our smaller churches. So they just, they may have, two or three teens at the grade 9 age.
While each church used to hold confirmation classes for those youth, that's had to change. Not enough kids, not enough volunteers.
So what we've done is we've brought all of the confirmation kids together, and we have one program.
Even in the city, shrinking numbers are a problem.
As you see, a lot of marble and beautiful furniture.
Father Eric Bem is describing his church on the corner of Oxford and Jubilee in Halifax. He says it used to have 6 masses a week. Now it's down to 4. Since August, he's had to serve 2 churches.
Vocations are going down, and most of the vocations in here have come from the import. I'm the example of that.
Father Bem came from Poland to help with the decreasing number of priests in the Halifax-Yarmouth diocese. Meanwhile, Moore is doing her best to put a positive spin on all the changes.
It's just a really nice opportunity for kids that age to see that there are a lot of other kids practicing their faith, as well as a nice big group of kids to go through that journey with.
Moore's son is doing confirmation classes now, along with 18 other Catholic youth from across the valley. For The Signal, I'm Olivia Malley.
Last year, a Dartmouth musician challenged himself to do something he loves every week, but usually doesn't have time for. Write songs. A lot of them. Now he's ready to record the results. Ethan Lang has the story.
In a small living room on a residential street in Dartmouth, George Woodhouse is rehearsing with his band, The Public Service.
1, 2, 3, 4.
They're getting ready to record their first album.
I feel really excited, but it's been such a long burn that it just feels, at this point, like it has to happen.
That's because the upcoming album and the band itself sprung from a personal project that started over a year and a half ago.
For my 28th birthday, I gifted myself with a challenge to write one song every week because I was a bit down on myself about songwriting. It's one of my greatest passions, and I wasn't really doing it.
Woodhouse wound up with 47 songs in 52 weeks. He posted each one on Facebook and got a big response from friends and followers. So he decided to form a band to showcase some of his work live. Andrew McCormick is the drummer in the band. He says the quantity of material has helped Woodhouse.
Where I'm like, I'm not putting out anything until it's finished. That's like a good quality to have, but it also sometimes can hinder you. Because like people who just like get content out, like bang, 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 bang. And it gets traction and it gets their name out.
The group is now recording demos of about 10 of the 47 songs, along with a few new ones. Woodhouse hopes the album will be a start, not a finish.
It doesn't feel like a culmination, per se. It feels like a door opening more than a door closing.
They plan to record the studio album in January with a local producer. That gives them some time to work out the kinks.
Hey guys, I'm so sorry.
No, don't worry about it.
Just let this all down, man.
For The Signal, I'm Ethan Lang.
You can catch George Woodhouse and The Public Service live at the Carlton on December 15th. Here's their song Home and Me from their upcoming untitled album. It's going to play us out.
Got a song in my chimney, hey, hey. I got a lot of home in me, hey. Got a lot of home in me, hey, hey. I got a fire in my belly. A song in my chimney, hey.
That's our show for today. If there's anything you want to hear again, we'll be posting a link on our social media feeds. Our handle is Signal Radio HFX on Twitter and Instagram.
Or use our hashtag, Signal Radio. We'd love to hear from you if you have any thoughts on the show.
Thanks this week to producer Dane Patterson and associate producer Leslie Amundson. Andrea McGuire was our social media editor.
Mark Pinio is in the control room, assisted by Sam Gillett. And our audio professor is Pauline Dakin.
We'll be back next week with the last show of the term. I'm Christina Pappas.
And I'm Ben Bogsty. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.